Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Developments in this year's presidential race continue at a breakneck pace. This week's developments include the news that GOP House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin will no longer campaign for or defend nominee Donald Trump, and the news that Trump has gone on the attack not just against his Democratic rival, but also Republicans such as Ryan and Arizona Senator John McCain.
Meanwhile, NPR's Brian Naylor reported yesterday that it appears Donald Trump was quoting a Russian propaganda piece taken from a WikiLeaks document dump that misinterpreted an email hacked from the account of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager.
That somewhat confusing tale is where we start our conversation with foreign policy contributor Art Sear of Carthage College. Hi, Art. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for welcoming me back, Mitch. It's one of the most enjoyable things I do, as well as one of the most worthwhile.
Well, I hope we can continue to live up to that.
Hope it continues to be enjoyable.
Exactly.
I'm sure it will.
Let's start with what seems like a strange combination here. Russia and the U.S. presidential election. There are allegations, some would say well-founded allegations, that the propaganda arm of the Russian government is trying to sway the presidential election towards Donald Trump. First off, what do you make of this story?
Well, it may well be true. We just don't know. I think Americans should feel confident, partly because the Russians are so ham-handed traditionally, successors of the ham-handed Soviets in these matters. In 1984, the Soviet government actually formally endorsed Walter Mondale, who was in a desperate losing struggle with the very effective President Ronald Reagan. And that completely sank his candidacy. So we should not be surprised that Hillary Clinton has been constantly referring to this alleged Russian interference.
Well, and it's interesting to think about because it's kind of amazing to consider that the Soviet government, not all that many years ago, quite a few years ago, I guess at this point, would endorse Walter Mondale. And now the allegations are that they've kind of done a 180 here because Donald Trump is about the most anti-Walter Mondale that you could imagine.
Absolutely. In terms of personal character as well, that's very well put. I hadn't been thinking of that, but you're absolutely right. And that's the most important dimension. Mondale was the protege and close ally of Hubert Humphrey, a very great and very positive American political leader, in my view, and a very, very effective one.
Well, what would you think that the Russian government at this point would see in a Donald Trump presidency that would want to make them sway the election?
Making mischief is one factor. We tend to assume that dictatorships and then autocracies are extremely well organized from the top. That's not true even during the Soviet years, even during the Third Reich and World War II. There's a lot of disorganization in Russia today, especially compared to the predecessor regime, and I'm not at all sure that it's not freelancers who are doing this. Putin has spoken very favorably about Trump. He certainly knows what he's doing and is consistent. And I think one reason is that Trump is, he plays to the worst stereotypes that many people overseas have of the U.S. Also, I think he would be an easier leader to deal with because he's so uninformed and, frankly, inept. I realize he's gotten the Republican nomination, but for various reasons, I'm sure Putin would welcome the chance to have him as leader of the U.S.
So this is not a case where Russia thinks of Trump as some sort of unlikely ally. It's a question of they see Trump as a weaker person to have in place as the U.S. leader.
Yes. Putin is more aware than most people of the strong conflicts of interest, of national interest between the U.S. and Russia, and that's the way he looks at the world. And that's the way a leader, including the President of the United States, should look at the world.
Well, and that's interesting because even before this point of the campaign, there has been plenty of scrutiny of Donald Trump for what he's said about Russia and Russian President Putin. And a lot of it has obviously been overshadowed by some other things, other scrutiny that Donald Trump has gotten. But there was talk of Trump's apparent praise of Putin's, quote, leadership. And that does raise some questions about what people are talking about when they talk about being a leader.
Well, I think thugs are attracted to each other, bluntly, and the strongman qualities of Putin that make him so popular in Russia at some level, I'm sure, are admired by Mr. Trump.
As I follow the story of the potential tampering with the U.S. election, I can't also help but think that the U.S. has tried to sway an election or two in years past, maybe not in quite the same ham-handed way. But, you know, is there something different about how something like this plays out circa 2016 versus, as you say, 1984, when the Soviet government endorsed Walter Mondale, or any number of other occasions when the U.S. via the CIA might have tried to sway an election somewhere else?
We not only tried to sway elections, but we overthrew governments and we killed leaders, and certainly tried to in the case of Fidel Castro for many years. The rule of law, transparency, are becoming much more pervasive in the world, and I think all Americans especially should keep that in mind, because we tend to feel beleaguered. It was easier to do things in secret in the past. The Cold War was not literally a war, but it was an intense conflict. It was a conflict which the U.S. and Western democracies could have lost, just as we could have lost World War II. And I do believe there are circumstances when interfering in the affairs of foreign countries is appropriate.
So does the 2016 election kind of represent a return to some of the Cold War zeitgeist?
No, I don't really think so, for all kinds of reasons, including changes in American culture. No, I certainly hope we're not returning to a Cold War atmosphere. We do seem to be very fearful in this country. It's easy to talk the way I am when you have a job and are relatively secure. Overall, our economy is strong. A lot of people are having to struggle. We have not had a second strike, a second 9/11, since that terrible September 11th in 2001. Yet some of them are successful in playing to this tremendous pervasive fear.
The other interesting thing about this story of the Russians' attempt to sort of inject some propaganda into the U.S. election is maybe the unlikely merger of what's going on in Syria, because that's sort of in the background of all this, and our response to it with the ongoing controversy over WikiLeaks. I guess I'll stop the question there. We're seeing both Syria and WikiLeaks kind of in the background of this story.
Yeah, regarding the latter, WikiLeaks, I guess that's one reason I mentioned that it's harder to operate in secret. I am regularly amazed at how not just junior staffers in Washington, but very senior people put all kinds of things in email, which I always consider public information. Even though my communications are innocuous and not particularly interesting to anyone, especially U.S. intelligence agencies, but consider it public information, just as good advice. In the case of Syria, after the Suez Crisis in 1956, which Eisenhower, as usual, handled extremely well, our ties with Israel actually became closer, even though we had been opposed to one another in that particular crisis. The Soviet Union effectively captured the Arab states. The only one left in terms of their traditional allies is Syria, but they are traditional allies. We have no direct interest in Syria, let me emphasize, because politicians talk as though we do. We have no national interest in Syria. They're not a great oil producer. We do have an interest in limiting and, if possible, obliterating ISIS. But I think we are very wise not to get directly involved on the ground. I think that can only be counterproductive.
And I was going to ask where humanitarian concerns fall in that, though.
Well, the new Secretary General of the United Nations is going to take over from Ban Ki-moon at the end of December, I believe. Mr. Gutierrez is currently the head of the UN High Commission on Refugees, as well as a former prime minister of his home country, Portugal. I think he was selected in part because he's a very good politician, a very able leader. But also he's been stage center and heavily responsible for the tremendous humanitarian challenge in the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. Humanitarian relief is extremely important, and I hope that my tough-talking, realistic comments about the state of the world in the Mideast don't take away from the fact that humanitarian relief is a principal responsibility, and there the U.S. is and has been historically a great leader.
Meanwhile, the future of peace in Colombia looked promising, but the end of that country's longstanding civil war was defeated in a referendum, which surprised a whole lot of people. I think it was perhaps only slightly less surprising, maybe slightly more surprising than the Brexit vote was. So what was going on there?
Well, that's an interesting analogy. It was, like Brexit, a very close vote. We're talking about war and peace, life and death in the case of Colombia, fortunately not in the case of Britain and Europe, which demonstrates that the European Union has, in fact, succeeded in its main purpose. It was a very close vote. The current president of Colombia, who spearheaded the agreement, has lost a lot of popularity. I think that was a factor. Differential turnout. Some areas where there was a lot of public support for the peace accord had relatively low turnout. Those who were opposed were mobilized by the many politicians who were against it. The FARC, the revolutionary group that's partly communist insurgency, partly enormous drug production and selling operation, the FARC has indicated they're going to abide by the ceasefire, and I think that's what's really important, what forces in the field, what armed forces actually do. So I remain relatively optimistic.
Well, and I gather one of the concerns that many people in Colombia had with the peace accord was that it didn't do enough to punish the FARC rebels.
Yeah, well, it's a peace agreement. You're not going to get everything you want, whether it's a peace agreement in Colombia or closer to home, the Chicago Teachers Union reaching an agreement with Mayor Emmanuel. The war went on for many, many years, a half century. It seemed until fairly recently to be a repeat of Vietnam all over again. We were sending many increasing numbers of advisors, uniformed and civilian, military and police. We were sending helicopter gunships, more and more small arms. President George W. Bush, like Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, went to great lengths to keep Colombia out of the news. And just like Vietnam until 1965, when we escalated it, we seemed to be turning a blind eye to it. Unlike earlier periods in our history, we are focusing very, very heavily on what to me are pretty superficial and often silly concerns in our political debate. National security really should be more stage center, and we should have been talking about this more. But I remain optimistic about the agreement, and I hope I'm right.
You remain optimistic about the agreement. I would imagine that you're maybe like the rest of us, somewhat less optimistic that national security concerns will be front and center in the next presidential
debate. Outside of superficial talk about terrorism, no. That's interesting. I show my students, they're so audiovisual, and I'm trying to keep up with the world, I show them videos, but I get even by making them old videos. Executive Suite, a great Hollywood film of the 50s, which I commend to all our listeners, with some profound lessons about what nowadays we call gender relations in academia. I show them the first Kennedy-Nixon debate in 1960, and the students generally think they're both really good. Occasionally a class is swept away by JFK, but they're both good. They both talk like grown-up men. They're polite to one another. They talk about policy in impressive and in-depth ways, and I make the point, well, there were two men in 1960. A man who behaved then the way Donald Trump does today would actually not be a man. He'd be something different and something considerably less. The fact that our public discourse has changed so dramatically regarding what it means to be a man, I think, is instructive for all of us. And I'll stop at that point.
Kennedy and Nixon rolling over in their graves.
No doubt. But also the debate was supposed to deal with domestic policy. And Jack Kennedy shamelessly kept driving it into foreign policy. The Soviet Union is ahead of us. They're going to defeat us if we're not careful in education and engineering and science, as well as the military field. All quite wrong, as we know today, with 2020 hindsight. But that shows how serious we were in those days and how serious the Cold War was. None of the high, obviously partisan white male correspondents on the journalist panel called Kennedy on that, by the way. So bias is nothing new.
We'll leave it at that. Art Sear, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Art Sear is the Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, and he's the director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He joins us each month to talk about foreign policy.